From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts for the special series 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, building a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border and expelling undocumented immigrants by the thousands were two of President Trump's biggest campaign promises. He has fed anti-immigrant fervor with his on-again, off-again travel ban, which is now on again. But do Democrats share any blame? What can the left do better in the Trump era to protect immigrants? That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer at the Los Angeles Times. When Donald Trump descended that escalator to declare that he was running for president, he set the tone for the rest of the presidential race.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting. And it only makes common sense. It only makes common sense. They're sending us not the right people. It's coming from more than Mexico. It's coming from all over South and Latin America, and it's coming probably from the Middle East. But we don't know, because we have no protection and we have no competence. We don't know what's happening. And it's got to stop. And it's got to stop fast.
Little did we know that statement would form the basis of presidential policy one day. Off of that, let me introduce our panelists. Ruben Navarrete is back with us. He is a syndicated columnist, host of the podcast Navarrete Nation, and author of A Darker Shade of Crimson, Odyssey of a Harvard Chicano. He will also take over as the host of 1 year later on December 11th. Thanks for coming back and pulling some overtime, Ruben.
Hey, Jamil. Great to be with you again.
And Daniel Hernandez is here in studio with me. He's a journalist, writer, and former Mexico bureau chief for Vice News. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, Jamil. Thank you.
And also joining us is Christina Mora, sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research focuses on culture, race, ethnicity, and immigration. Thank you very much for joining us, Christina.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist, let me start with you. Trump's inflammatory rhetoric tends to get the most attention when talking about the current anti-immigrant mood. But you see a blame the immigrant thing also happening on the left side of the political spectrum. Can you explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. Thanks, Jamil. It's been happening for some time. Let's recall the last time Congress did anything significant, I would argue, on immigration reform. It was 1986. In 1986, when Congress passed IRCA, Immigration Reform and Control Act, that was a bill written chiefly by Al Simpson, a senator from Wyoming who was a Republican and signed into law by a Republican, Ronald Reagan, the president. It was opposed by many Democrats, opposed by the AFL-CIO, opposed by labor, because it's always been the case that organized labor and unions feel that too much immigration, illegal or legal, hurts American workers by driving down wages and creating more competition for jobs. I would cynically say that one of the chief effects is it makes U.S. workers work harder, get up earlier, work later, and they find it difficult to compete with immigrant workers and always have been. That's always been the case. And so in that regard, that kind of sentiment has always had a home in the Democratic Party.
Mm. Daniel Hernandez, you also feel that the left, you know, needs to do some work here. Basically, what have they failed to do?
Well, I would say that the Democrats have failed for decades, you know, just as Ruben said, they've never been able to fully, to their core, I think, fundamentally define their views on immigration. They've constantly used the issue as a political football to sacrifice, you know, in the first 100 days of a Democratic presidency, as they did with the Obama administration. The Dreamers, the young kids, literally had to force the Obama administration to do a presidential initiative to just make DACA policy. So I think all along the way, Democrats have failed. And it's true that there always has been division within the labor movement over what role immigration should play in their policy and in their interests.
Daniel, I want to have you listen to Congressman Luis Gutierrez of Illinois. He's the chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus. Here he is speaking in July at a church in Chicago.
In this country, I am clear. The Dreamers are not criminals. Those who have TPS are not criminals. The millions of undocumented workers that work every day, sweat and toil at some of the most miserable jobs in the United States of America are not criminals. We are going to determine, and history is going to determine, who those criminals are. And for me, the major criminal that exists in the United States of America is called Donald Trump. He lives at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue at the White House.
So, Daniel, it's easy to see why that would fire people up. But when you say that the left tends to just wag their finger at conservatives on immigration, is that the kind of statement you're talking about?
Right. I mean, Representative Gutierrez is in the trenches, but this is a kind of an obvious statement that he says in both regards. Of course, Dreamers aren't criminals. Dreamers are the best of the best. They're the cream of the crop. But they really shouldn't be placed on sort of a pedestal and used in this political manner. And it's very easy, I think, to throw these kind of political fireballs at President Trump, a very easy target. But that continues, I think, to mask the fact that the Democrats as a whole have been really unable to solve this issue. And it's really a political, the public is very much in favor, of immigration reform, and the country is ready for this. So why haven't both parties been able to get it done?
We're discussing immigration during the Trump era here on One Year Later. Christina Mora, sociology professor at UC Berkeley. Do you agree with that? Do you feel like there's a, you know, perhaps a respectability politics at play here in how Democrats talk about DACA recipients specifically, but also immigrants in total?
Oh, sure, of course. And I think DACA recipients themselves, the Dreamer movements, often themselves say this project, this sort of respectability for us and our sense of belonging is not just about us. It's about our parents. It's about our brothers and sisters. It's about the broader than us 11 million people. And many within the Dreamer movement are rejecting this sort of downright stereotypification and categorization of them as so distinct and so amazingly different from the rest of the 11 million people. And it's just unfortunate the way that message about them being part of this larger community hasn't come out, and in large part because it is a, you know, political football here.
And Christina, I want to follow up on that. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like sharing facts about why so many of the 11 million undocumented immigrants from Mexico, from Central America, you feel like sharing those facts would make a difference in this debate?
It's hard because at this political moment, I just don't know where facts are going. I mean, we can, you know, in 2007, the Congressional Budget Office, just like it had done in 2003, had this major report on sort of the economic cost of immigration, especially looking at unauthorized migration. And time and again, you know, all of our best economic analysis on the issue show that immigrants provide a net economic gain to the nation. Overall, there are costs that are shifted around different places, but overall, there's definitely a benefit to the small towns, to the large cities, statewide and nationwide. And yet, this rhetoric is completely lost, often within sort of a larger narrative of strangers among us, a tide of strangers coming in and invading, things of the sort. So I think, you know, we have facts. We have reams of facts. We have years and years of studies and longitudinal data about sort of the benefits of immigration to the nation. And yet sometimes the promise, oftentimes historically, not just now, historically the dominant narrative becomes, who are these people? They're taking our jobs. They're depressing our economies. They're bringing crime. When we have dozens and dozens of studies that show that immigration is not necessarily linked to higher crime. So I just, you know, I think it's one of these issues in which facts become spun and sent to the back burner to political narratives.
Yeah, I totally agree with completely agree with what Professor Mora just said. I mean, it really is a policy no-brainer. There is no reason this government in this incredibly wealthy country is not able to figure this out. Immigrants are a boon up and down the scale in almost every measurable way. However, again, the left has been unable to really make this issue their own. You know, unfortunately, right now, the great spiritual leader of the left, let's say, the mainstream leader, Barack Obama, in many sectors of this country will be unfortunately remembered as the deporter-in-chief for the kinds of negotiations that the Obama administration made over the years. So again, there is this gray area that so many people sort of exist in and need to be addressed. And it really is up to the two major parties to figure this out and find a solution.
Ruben Navarrete, I want you to jump in on this as well.
Sure. One of the reasons, Jamil, I find myself in the center on this debate and so many others, I really see a pox on both houses. I see the Democrats and Republicans have both systematically failed to address the immigration issue in an honest, trustworthy, clear way. That the left blows it, the right blows it. What I said before about Democrats pushing a certain kind of economic fear doesn't negate the fact that Republicans are pushing a different kind of fear, and that's cultural fear. Democrats tell you, you got to get rid of immigrants because they're taking your job away. And Republicans come forth and say, you got to get rid of immigrants because they're taking your culture away. They're turning your town into Little Mexico and the like. So both parties are pushing fear shamelessly. And Christina's absolutely right about the following. You know, we have facts, but facts, fear doesn't listen to facts. Fear has never listened to facts. And whether you're driving facts to the right or the left, the parties have not been receptive to that. I will say also there's been a refusal on both sides of the immigration debate to acknowledge facts they find inconvenient. You're never going to get folks on the right wing in the Republican Party acknowledging that much of the immigration debate is driven by racism and nativism and all kinds of other ugly isms and has been ever since Benjamin Franklin railed against the Germans in the late 1700s. Mm-hmm. But likewise, on the left, you're never going to get the left to acknowledge that these people are in the country illegally, that they're not criminals because we're talking about civil code and not criminal code, but they are lawbreakers. They broke a civil law to be here, and they do use oftentimes and put a strain on hospitals and jails and schools. Neither side wants to acknowledge what's unpopular and convenient for them.
Well, Christina Mora, I want to ask you then, you know, off of that point, is the left feel like, you know, they're maybe ignoring that, you know, or at least publicly ignoring that point about immigrants being lawbreakers because they're simply trying to be compassionate? Or do you feel like it's an error in not just how they devise policy, but how they sell it?
I think it's an error of omission more than anything. I mean, I don't really see Democrats right now at this moment sort of coming out against immigrants for the economic reasons. I think they're just not talking about it. They're just not talking about the positive net gains that immigrants bring. They're not saying that. What they're saying is we're focused on labor, we're focused on our people, we're focused on this, and then they're just not talking about it. And this is where the big omission comes, because where the debate, where it is talked about, is in the Republican Party. Now, in the Democratic Party, where it is sort of talked about, it'll be about sort of DACA, so just the 800,000, not the 11 million people, just the 800,000, or it's honestly talked about people like Congressman Luis Gutierrez or other congressmen, mainly Latino, that are coming out as fierce advocates for immigration, but yet are marginalized within the larger party on this issue.
Daniel, do Democrats not acknowledge the economic anxiety that non-immigrant folks are feeling? Now, obviously, racism does play a part in this, but there is actual economic anxiety that isn't just sort of this tagline that Republicans sell.
100%. Racism is obviously part of it. But really, again, the left and the Democrats have been unable to address the fact that immigrants have come and sort of taken over a lot of industries. You know, security guards, the hotel industry, the construction industry, let's say immigrant labor, really fuels those industries and buoys them up. But yes, they've been unable to acknowledge centrist Democratic policies that led to immigration. You know, the signing of the North American Free Trade Agreement in 1994 pushed a lot of Mexicans into poverty, pushed them off their farmland, and forced many of them to move into the United States illegally against the law, right? So Democrats can take a little more ownership and a little more responsibility for past policy initiatives that themselves helped fuel the immigration north to the United States.
Ruben Navarrete, can you bring us into the Trump era? Just want to have you talk a little strategy for Democrats here. What should they be doing in lieu of what they are doing now?
Wow, that's a good question. So first of all, they've got to be clear. They've got to be brave and clear and not be afraid to call out Trump for his obvious, you know, the dog whistles, the ethnic pandering, the racism. You know, my big problem with so much of what he said when he announced his campaign back in 2015, coming down the escalator, was not the part about calling the headline grabbing part about calling Latino immigrants and Mexican immigrants rapists and criminals, and not differentiating between illegal or legal immigrants, but just painting with a broad brush. For me, the part that really told me this person didn't understand immigration is when he said Mexico isn't sending its best people. I got news for you. Countries always send their best people. Okay. When people were coming from Italy 100 years ago, it was the best Italians who were coming. The ones who didn't have drive and initiative stayed in Italy. The best ones came here. It's always been that way. The Irish, the Germans, the Italians, and now the Mexicans. And I find it's strange, Jamil, and a little disheartening that Donald Trump on this point actually found common cause with the Mexican elitist, the elite Mexicans who stay in Mexico, who agree with Donald Trump that they are not sending their best people because they think they're the best people. And they're still living in Guadalajara and Mexico City. So elitism is certainly a problem, and it's something that wraps itself into the immigration debate. Democrats need to be honest about that and confront that and call that out. But they also need to stop pandering to Democrats in, for instance, Rust Belt states. Christina says she doesn't see Democrats pushing the economic fear. I see it all the time. I see it in Ohio when I go to Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I run into Democrats there who are union members who will stand up after my speeches and say, I'm a union member, been a Democrat my whole life, never voted for Republican. Now, when are we going to get rid of these Mexicans? They're driving down wages and they're costing me jobs at the factory. So it is clear that if you go to the right places and you go to Youngstown, Ohio, and you go to Pennsylvania, and you go to those places in the Rust Belt states, you definitely do see that economic fear and some really shameless Democrat politicians that are stoking it.
Well, this Cleveland, Ohio native will be right back with you with our guests. We're going to leave it right there. We're going to be having more conversation about immigration in the Trump era. This is 1 year later from PRI. Again, I'm Jamil Smith, and this is 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking about immigration in the year since President Trump's election and whether Democrats have the right tactics to deal with the White House's policy and rhetoric. Joining me are Ruben Navarrete, my co-host here on 1 year later, and a syndicated columnist, journalist Daniel Hernandez, former Mexico bureau chief for Vice News, and Christina Mora, sociology professor at UC Berkeley. Christina, I want to start with you, coming off of what we were talking about before the break. One of your current projects, we understand, deals with racial attitudes in working class neighborhoods. Ruben Navarrete brought up Youngstown before. I'm from near there. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I understand exactly what, you know, those sentiments are being propagated by a lot of working class communities. How has the right exploited tensions, do you feel, between black and brown, considering that Youngstown is primarily a black town?
Well, these small towns in the Midwest are actually really interesting because they're also the ones that have seen just a large increase in immigration as well. So even though there are many more immigrants in Los Angeles and in other places, sort of in these small Youngstown areas and the Midwest, you've almost seen a doubling in these small towns in Michigan and other areas. And I think the sudden surge of newcomers in many ways is, at the same time that manufacturing has gone, produces an anxiety and an opportunity for political elites to come in and spin that anxiety in ways that they'd like. So they come in and they say, look, you know, you don't have these jobs, these economic, you know, we're poor, we can't give our kids what our parents gave us. The future looks bleak. Blame it on the people that just came in. even though it doesn't make sense. The logic is not there. The jobs are not there. What these immigrants are coming in for, mainly service area jobs or jobs that wouldn't have given them Youngstown residents the economic opportunities in the first place to get ahead. And so I think it's very easy when people suddenly start seeing newcomers come in, there's a sense of difference, there's a sense of threat, there's a sense that the unknown has come in, things have changed, and this provides the opportunity for political elites to stoke fear and spin a narrative, and that's exactly what they're doing. On the right, in these informal town hall meetings and in these ways, on the left as well then.
Daniel, do you have any thoughts on this?
Oh, completely. I mean, I was just in Colorado and Kansas recently. And you know what struck me was that I didn't see anyone under, 25 who wasn't brown. Every young person that I saw in the middle of the country was some shade of brown. And when I go there, I mean, I grew up here in Southern California. When I see the middle of the country and how much it has changed, there has been a great radical demographic shift that is evident all over the country, really, to be frank about it, a browning of the country that we've witnessed in the past 15 years that people on the left need to acknowledge and figure out how to address those anxieties that irrevocably happen and will continue to happen. We dealt with it here in California 20, 30 years ago. Black-brown tensions have always been a topic here. The kind of white racist backlash we saw against immigration in the 90s in California with the politics of former Governor Pete Wilson. We've been here. California should really be a leader and a blueprint on how to figure this out and how to address the negative impacts that Ruben mentioned earlier, the strain that happens on certain communities and on certain infrastructure under this onslaught, this demographic change that we're seeing.
Ruben Navarrete, Daniel brings up a really important point here, I think. Should the left be looking to the states which, you know, are heavily Democratic for examples on how to confront this problem?
Well, it's certainly one of the front lines. You know, if you think about it, just in sheer political terms, Democrats have certain blue states that are dependable. Republicans have red states that are dependable. It can't be denied that Donald Trump is president today because he won four critical battleground states that nobody saw coming, frankly. We were focused on Ohio. Sure, we'd been there before, Colorado and Florida, but no one thought that this would come down to four battleground states in the Rust Belt, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. States that Bernie Sanders, it's worth pointing out, won against Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. States that are heavily Democratic. States where, unfortunately, many of the people who voted for Donald Trump in those states were Democrats. Were Democrats who bought into the economic message about immigrants and other messages that he was selling about trade and about how the world was coming in and treating us unfairly. And it had resulted in the closing of factories and the dying of the American dream. They bought the whole thing. They bought it all. And a lot of those folks were Democrats. So, yeah, I think it would be really smart for the Democratic Party to focus in on the Rust Belt states and make the economic argument to those immigrants that my friends on this segment have also agreed to, that this is not make the argument to those residents that immigrants are not the problem, that they have to deal with automation and globalization and lots of other things that are causing factories to close down, and immigrants aren't the bad guy.
Christina Moore, I want to ask you, how can the left do better to help fight back against the exploitation of the black-brown divide, for instance, or any other immigration issue? Whether it's our elected officials, whether it's folks out here listening, what can the left do better?
Oh, I don't really see this as a term. I don't really like to see this question in terms of party politics. I'd rather see this question in terms of social movements. I think, for example, on the question of the black-brown divide, I think that this is a question that's best answered by Latino media, Latino churches, Latino labor unions, Latino civic organizations that can step out of sort of the political rhetoric and sort of rat race to what is, what's going to win votes and what's going to win support, to really getting at how can we build bridges around communities, across communities. Here's where Latino churches and black churches really do a good job at bringing groups together. This is where Latino media can really do a good job of sensitizing Latinos as to their own sort of racist understandings of difference in America as well. With the larger question on immigration reform, I also see it this way. I see I see the future and strategies. Where I do see it somewhat bleak because of the structure of American party politics, the electoral system and whatnot, I tend to have much more faith in the grassroots institutions. You know, in 2006, there were mass immigrant rights movements, and there was a moment in which, if you look at it, immigrant and especially Latino institutions across the board were operating with such a level of synchronicity, right? There were churches, you know, helping people get out to the march site. There were disc jockeys, radio shows, television, you know, all of the Latino institutions coming together to really get the message out, to sort of get people on the street to bring this message up forward. Now, there are debates as to sort of what was the aftermath and whether there was a backlash about this. But I really do think now that moving forward, party politics is one thing. What the Democratic Party wants to do as a whole is one thing, and I think this should definitely be separated by what sort of Latino grassroots organizations, and also sort of institutionalized lobbies from NCLR to LULAC and other organizations can do on their own independent of the party system.
You're listening to One Year Later. We're discussing immigration in the Trump era. This is a special presentation of Left, Right, and Center and Public Radio International. Daniel Hernandez, I want you to respond to that a little bit, because a lot of, you know, these movements that Christina is talking about are led on the left by white progressives. Right. It's just a simple fact. They supposedly share the same agenda as immigrants, but you don't necessarily see that. Can you talk a little bit about what you've known, you know, what you've seen from your reporting?
Oh, completely. I was there on, I believe it was March 26, 2006. 1 million people peacefully marched on the streets of downtown LA. It was probably the biggest march in the state's history, a watershed moment. That moment was very powerful because it visibilized immigrants and sort of how mainstream fundamentally and how central they are now to the lives of so many cities and communities in this country. Ever since then, once again, the sort of status quo standard bearer political leaders were unable to harness that energy and really the love and the outpouring of support that came from broader American society when there were thousands of similar demonstrations happening all over the country in that year. So again, we've had a lot of glorious and wonderful moments in the, I believe, evolution that this country is going through in sort of absorbing and bringing in so many different people in this wave of immigration from Mexico and Central America. Mm-hmm. But really, we got to step up and the leaders have to figure out, both in civil society and in the political class and in the corporate business private sector, figure out a way to normalize so many people who are contributing to society today. But unfortunately, we have this person in the White House, President Trump, who is the easy and simple kind of fall guy to take the blame on not being able to figure this out. But I really don't think that President Trump should be a hindrance to immigration reform. I think I think beneath the bluster, he really would like to see a solution to this problem. That's why he footballed it over to Congress.
Mm. Ruben Navarrete, I want to pivot a little bit to Muslim immigration. You know, to this point, we've seen the courts be an effective check on President Trump's most nativist impulses. But this week, an appeals court here in California let Trump's ban against travelers from six majority Muslim countries go into effect. That applies to people without U.S. connections flying from Iran, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Chad. Have opponents of the president's immigration agenda relied too heavily on the courts?
I think they have. I think that's an appropriate check on the president's power in this regard, obviously, and the Constitution says so. And I'm glad to see the courts doing what they're doing. But again, this is a very difficult issue for many Democrats to take on. It's hard for people to stand up in the face of polling data that shows vast majorities of Americans supporting the idea of limiting or at least increasing vetting of refugees and immigrants from certain countries. Now, notice that is much different than the way that the president very clumsily presented this idea at the beginning as a Muslim ban. But when you explain it the way I did in terms of targeted countries, you have vast majority of the people, including Latinos, African Americans, and others, who think that's pretty reasonable. And when you have attacks on U.S. soil, like the one that recently occurred from an ISIS an ISIS devotee, an ISIS follower in New York, and other attacks closer to home here in California, like the one in San Bernardino, where you have an element. In that case, it was a mixed bag because you had someone who was born here and someone who came in to the country from another country. It does strike fear into the minds of many people. And I do have a concern that we have this ongoing immigration debate and Latinos want to stand up on a table and shout, look, we're a whole different population. You know, mm-hmm. Don't mix apples and oranges. Don't make this about a national security issue. This is, in fact, about an economic security issue. We come here because there are jobs available, period. So I think there is a danger there. The president has overreached, has been very clumsy in the way he produces this. And it plays into this idea, Jamil, and I'll say this, that mm-hmm. there's a kind of demographic purge going on. We can't get beyond the fact that Donald Trump espouses and exudes a kind of racial agenda that would seem to say that the people he's most interested in deporting on the one hand, or guarding us against their entry on the other hand, are always non-white people. Hmm. And that is a problem. They've not been able to shake it. It's constantly reinforced.
Racial agenda is a very kind way of putting it, my friend.
Yeah.
Christina Moore, I want to ask you, just maybe we can end on a constructive note. Are Democrats and liberals, which are not always the same thing, as we know,
no.
doing anything really right with regards to immigration on a national level? And, you know, should they be taking more cues, as you mentioned, from movement, you know, movement activists?
I think there are some that are. Luis Gutierrez is a perfect example. There are some that are very much sort of in conversation with churches, in conversation with, you know, unions that are mainly immigrant-based, in conversation with these civil rights organizations that are operating on the ground. And I think they're the ones that have the human story. They're the ones that have the alternative narratives that are not just about sort of these are the good immigrants, these are the ones that have also American values, mm-hmm. But that are giving the situation a much more human face, and they're the bravest. They're the ones shouting the loudest. They're the ones sitting outside of Congress. They're the ones that constantly are taking to the media. So I think part of this, given that we have reams and reams of facts, given that, you know, we can produce, social science can produce another study on immigration and crime, immigration and economics. We can, but we have so many already. Given that all the facts are there, it's all laid out, this is really about who's spinning the narrative, who's spinning the story, and then who's doing the strategizing behind them. And since we don't see party politics doing it, I mean, I think that a much more creative answer is going to be this hybrid of sort of really brave politicians on the left going out and reaching out in civil society and using the range of tactics that, minority rights issues have used before. Everything from sort of using different types of media to protest to different and new forms of political engagement. They need to keep at the narrative, and they need to come up with new tactics and new ways of strategizing this. Otherwise, we're going to be in an issue in which the ones that, you know, that it's only the right that is that has the dominant narrative about them, and that is about culture, that is about mm-hmm. who belongs, and that is about national safety. And none yeah. of that should really take precedent on this issue.
Thank you. All right. We have to leave it there. Thanks to all of my guests. Ruben Navarrete, columnist and host of the podcast Navarrete Nation, and of course, host of this show as of December 11th. Daniel Hernandez, journalist and former Mexico bureau chief for Vice News, and Christina Mora, sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you to the three of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, taxes, healthcare, and the future of the Republican Party, no big deal, our Talk It Out segment when we come back with 1 year later from PRI. I'm Jamil Smith, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show where we talk it out, where we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the left, we bring in Jim Antle. He is the politics editor at the Washington Examiner and our voice from the right today. Hello, Jim.
Hey, Jamil.
So, Jim, I want to start with the tax bill and the new introduction of a repeal of the individual mandate that's been put into it. This year, right. The Republican Congress tried multiple times to repeal Obamacare, of course, and they failed. Now their next legislative focus is supposedly just tax reform, but this week the Senate bill added a provision that would get rid of the requirement for Americans to have health insurance under Obamacare. Just kind of want to get your idea of whether or not that's a smart thing to do, given the fact that it seems like they were struggling to get votes for tax reform as it is.
Well, it's interesting. I think that Republicans want to show that they can actually accomplish some of the things that they promised to do. And so far, at least on the legislative side of that, they haven't had a lot of success. I mean, on Obamacare, they ran into the problem that once repeal became a live issue rather than a theoretical issue, you no longer are hearing from just the people who feel that they're worse off under Obamacare, but you also start to hear from the people who feel that they're better off, and they now have something concrete that they could lose if Republicans actually act on this stuff. And two, you had a real big Republican division on Medicaid after a number of states had adopted the Medicaid expansion. So once a Medicaid expansion was in place, you had a number of even fairly conservative Republicans like Senator Rob Portman of Ohio who were really reluctant to support anything that would sort of ratchet that back. So Republicans kind of blew up over that. And I think there's a hope among some Republicans that by bringing it back to the individual mandate, they can get to something that is a less popular feature of the law and also get some of the revenue that might be available to them that they didn't get by doing health care reform first before they did tax reform.
But I'd argue that even less popular than perhaps the individual mandate is 13 million people being without health insurance, which is the projected number of people who would either have to drop or would lose their coverage as a result of repealing this mandate. It seems like they're trying to make this bill more unpopular than it already is. It seems like even most Republican voters don't really want tax reform, or at least don't like the bills that have been put forth. What should Republicans do to garner more support or at least more political cover for this?
Well, it seems to me that the dilemma Republicans have is that President Trump has some decent political instincts on some of these things, but he has literally next to no policy knowledge, so he has no idea how to translate those political instincts into actual legislation. So he, I think, understands that it should, generally speaking, be a more middle-class-centric type of tax cut. He is relying, he's sort of outsourcing, despite being very anti-outsourcing, he is outsourcing the policy details to a Republican congressional leadership that has very different political instincts than I think he does. And I think they are having trouble working that out. And Trump obviously doesn't provide a kind of normal presidential leadership where he's forming legislation from the White House, where he's really telling Republicans what to do or where to go other than via Twitter. And then the tweets are confusing and they're not really necessarily informed substantively. So they don't really give Republicans that much guidance. And then the Republican members of Congress worry that they don't know where Trump really stands on some of these things and that they're just going to one morning wake up and be hit on Twitter for doing something the president doesn't like.
Speaking of the president, he promised that there would be a tax bill on his desk by December. But the House bill and the Senate bill are two very different things and with different percentages, specifically just with the taxes. Forget about anything else they try to jam in there. Do you think that is going to happen? Do you think he's going to actually have that bill on his desk by December as promised?
That would be a really, really tough pull to get it by Christmas. I know he wants the talking point, from a marketing perspective of this tax cut as a Christmas gift to you. But legislatively speaking, that I think is going to be really difficult to do. I do think some kind of legislation is likely to pass early next year simply because Republicans, one, feel under the gun to do something. And two, because even though there are some divisions on tax policy, there's far greater consensus among Republicans on tax policy than there ever was on health care. I mean, their consensus point on health care was simply, we don't like what the Democrats are doing or have done, but you know, once you are actually making the policy yourself, simply not liking Obamacare is not sufficient. So you have to have an alternate policy vision that you're willing to make the case for and maybe take some political risks for, like when Democrats were willing to risk their congressional majorities to pass Obamacare in the first place. I think they're more willing to do that on taxes and a little more confident on taxes than they ever were on health care.
Mm. Well, speaking of the tax cut, Democrats are arguing very forcefully that it won't help the middle class despite the GOP's sales pitch.
Right.
You know, that the facts, despite what Fox News is trying to do, the facts are seeping out. And it seems, again, that most Republican voters don't like the fact that this is going to primarily benefit wealthy Americans. What are the Republicans doing to counter that, or at least to, you know, hopefully, you know, for their sake, get to a point where they can pass it and not worry about being thrown out of office come next November?
Well, my sense is that, regardless of what some polling might say, is that you know, I don't think that there's really going to be a huge backlash in Republican districts against the bill. But you do have a number of people who, 23 House members specifically, who are representing districts that were won by Hillary Clinton last year, and then also some more blue collar congressional districts where the president is popular, and really where those voters come down on it, I think will have a really big impact in terms of whether any tax bill hurts Republicans. I think with Republicans, they've not been willing to look at things like cutting the payroll tax. They've not been willing to look at some things that might actually prevent the tax bill from being more skewed towards cutting tax rates for the wealthy. So, you know, there are a lot of Republican voters who do buy into the argument that, tax cuts, even for the wealthy, the rising tide lifts all the boats. It will be good for economic growth. But still, I think you have to provide tax relief for your actual voters. And
right.
Wealthy people, even for the Republican Party, are not the majority of your voters.
I mean, at what point are the Republicans going to abandon the trickle-down economics talking point? I mean, it's been proven that it doesn't work, or at least it doesn't work as they advertise it to. They just keep selling this idea that if you give wealthy executives or wealthy company owners, what have you, more money, that they're going to, so generously distribute it amongst their middle class workers. And we've seen that doesn't happen. It never really has. How do they keep getting away with this?
Well, I mean, a question I think is whether you can make tax policy changes that are altering incentives, returns on investment, incentives to expand your business, incentives to hire people. But there does obviously need to be tax cuts for a broader array of people. When the supply side program was at its peak political popularity, you had the fact that you had a lot of middle class families getting unlegislated tax increases through inflation induced bracket creep. You had tax rates, even for the wealthier, that were much higher and closer to what supply-side economists would consider the prohibitive range, where your tax rates become self-defeating. With a top tax rate below 40%, it's been much more difficult to generate the kind of political and economic impact without major revenue losses, yet it still remains a priority among a lot of important Republican voters. I mean, late Robert Novak said that God put Republicans on earth to cut taxes, and if they don't do that, then what good are they? Republicans are still, I think, trying to search for an answer of what good are they if they can't do that.
Real quick, we talked about Zimbabwe earlier in the show. The country's military has put the president, Robert Mugabe, under house arrest. I can't help thinking with that show of military might, of the concept of a military coup in the United States. Now, I'm not saying it's likely, but certainly there's been a prioritization, or at least a celebration, of military influence in the executive branch. Can you speak a little bit to that? And personally, it's a little worrisome.
Yeah, and I think that you've seen this celebration really across the political spectrum, because a number of people, I think, were hoping that the generals that President Trump put in his cabinet and in his White House staff would be a liberalizing influence on the Trump administration. Maybe people feel less inclined to view that way about John Kelly now than before he was White House chief of staff. But I think, I mean, you do sometimes see people tweeting about when the generals are going to, you know, invoke, the 25th Amendment and take Trump out, and, you know, all these kinds of things. And yeah, I think it's a dangerous thing to not celebrate the civilian control of our federal government. I mean, I think we're very far away from having any Zimbabwe-like problems in this country. But, you know, political norms are important.
Thank you, Jim Antle, politics editor for The Washington Examiner. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today on One Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for our show on guns, race, and the Second Amendment in the age of Trump. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.